Good morning, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Last evening we saw the way God chose to introduce Jacob into the divine record, a man whose life and influence was to be very prevalent right across the history of the nation that came from him and on right through to our day. But it's very interesting, is it not, brothers and sisters, that right at the very beginning of his life, in fact, before he even came into the world, while he was in the womb, he was involved in a terrible struggle, a struggle that is the history of the world. It is the great drama of the ages that begins in Genesis and goes right through until Revelation, and is what all of our lives are involved in. And here, typically, this man who was to have so much influence on others is introduced to us from the very moment of his birth as locked in a struggle. A terrible struggle that involved two manner of people. In fact, not just two manner of people, but two manners of thinking. And we go back right to the very beginning when sin entered the world and there became the divergence of two seeds, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And there he is portrayed, Jacob is portrayed right from the earliest times as a member of the seed of the woman who was in conflict, in enmity with the seed of the serpent. In particular, immediately there in his own household with his brother. But it wasn't to stay there. And in fact, God is very careful in the introduction of this man into the record to highlight to us that that was not the extent and the only extent of the difficulties and the struggle that he would face. But we are told at that very time that his mother was a Syrian. And there was to come into his life another issue that was to cause struggle. Not just this external enmity that was to be manifest between him and his brother, but there was also to be, by factor of his birth, there was to be another influence which he was going to have to struggle with all his days. And how real is that to all of us, brethren and sisters? We come here this morning because we all have that struggle. Not only do we have an external struggle because we have chosen to walk the way of God, and we find that as soon as we make a decision to become part of the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent rises and there is enmity inevitably, as God predicted that there would always be between those who thought carnally and those who thought spiritually. And yet, brothers and sisters, our bigger problem is in fact what we have by birth. That is our misfortune, but not our fault. But we live with it. We are born with the nature that we have. We are born with, as it were, in type, the Syrian characteristic. And in the record here of Genesis, the fact that Jacob was a Syrian by birth through his mother is paralleled typically with our experience with the flesh. And we could just equate those two things, our nature and him being a Syrian. And so his life and his experience is all the more useful and helpful to us as we endeavour to pattern our lives upon the one that we've truly come here to remember, who, though he bore that same nature, yet listened every day to the word of his father, to another voice apart from the voice of the flesh, the voice of the Syrian, and thereby overcame completely and brought victory for himself and all those who are his. Well, when we observe, as we made note of last night, brethren and sisters, the record of Jacob's life and the selective nature of those incidents that are there, we know actually very little about his early life. The incident that we considered last night in chapter 25 is not timed in the record. It happened somewhere between his birth and when he was about in his 50s. And the only other incident that we know in that early period is the one that we've read of here this morning in chapter 27. So we have the incident concerning the birthright, which had occurred at some point in his earlier life, which identified in the record the characteristics of these two sons of Isaac. And then we don't hear anything else except when we get now to this incident of the blessing that brought the struggle between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman to a head. In fact, it highlighted not just that external struggle. It in fact highlighted more appropriately and more significantly for us, it highlighted the internal difficulty and the struggle that Jacob himself was to be in all his days. And it gets to the point where God intervenes directly in his life and takes over. Not that God had not been concerned or not in Jacob's life until this point. He unquestionably was. But in a very dramatic way, through the circumstances that happened here in chapter 27, God just took over and began to use the circumstances in his life to help him face the difficulties that he faced by his background. Well, when we come to chapter 27, it's a story that we all know exceedingly well. Most of us have read this and heard this story since we were little children. And it's a very dramatic story. But it's interesting to note that Jacob and Esau at this stage were about 57 years of age, the two of them. They're not young lads. They're about 57 years old at this stage. And the incident in itself is really interesting in this respect, that it just suddenly bursts onto the scene. That is, just one day, very unexpectedly and without any warning, Jacob is suddenly in a situation where he's put to the test in what was a very ordinary, everyday circumstance of daily life. Now, you might not think that every day someone says they're going to die, but that's not the point. The point is, it was just a normal reaction of a human family that brought about this whole drama that changed forever the direction of this man's life. And we see the hand of God working through all of that. And God will work through really very ordinary circumstances, brethren and sisters. They don't have to be big and mighty events in our lives. We don't have to wait for the dramatic, because sometimes God can just turn our lives on something that is very minor at the time. And our reaction to that very minor thing might be the very thing that God uses to take our lives down a path to teach us the lessons of life. But though the story is not a pleasant one in actual fact, of course we like to hear the story because of its drama and the intrigue that's going on and how everything just works out at the end. But it's not a very pleasant story, but it is one that has absolutely profound lessons in there for all of us, brethren and sisters. You know, no one in this story emerges in a good light. No one. Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, or Esau. None of them come out of this in a good light. But before we are too critical, let us understand that all we know about Jacob until this point is that he is a godly, upright, perfect man, dwelling from a very young age in tents, content to have the promises of God. And Isaac, his father, is a faithful and godly man, and Rebekah, his mother, is a faithful and godly woman. And almost every other thing we read about Rebekah, apart from in this one day, is that she was a woman of towering faith. So let's not lose sight of the fact that in God's sight, these were giants of faith. All the more reason why we should look at them, brethren and sisters, because here's one day, just one day, when something didn't go quite right in their lives. They made some wrong decisions. They were pushed by circumstances and compromised in ways that we don't find hard to understand, because we're in similar circumstances at times. It was unquestionably one of those chapters of their life, one of those days of their life they would prefer to have just closed and not let anyone see. And yet God has opened it for our benefit. Not for theirs, it can't help them, but it can help all of us. And every one of them failed under pressure that day. But let's not be too harsh on them, but let's learn from them. This incident is painted so that we ourselves can see ourselves here and learn how to respond. Well, the amazing thing, in an overview sense, about this is that every member of that family was planning his or her own evil device. And yet God, in the end, by the evil of one, defeats the evil of another and saves his purpose with to bless that race that was to come through Isaac and eventually through Jacob from being absolutely frustrated, because that had the potential for that to happen that day. And God is working through all of that, even though every one of those members of that family have their own little agenda and are all working in different directions. God is actually still superintending the whole of that and still keeps his purpose on track. It's just utterly amazing to see the way God was able to do that, brethren and sisters. And we stand back in awe at the providence of God through that circumstance and the way he was able to do that. But brethren and sisters, God hasn't stopped doing that. This is just a snapshot of one day in these ordinary people's lives who were trying to live godly lives of faith, who were looking for the hand of God in their lives. And that's the experience of us all. And God will open up our eyes one day and we'll be able to look back at various circumstances in our life, if we can't do it even now, and see with just such amazement as we look at this, just how he was working. Because it's here for our instruction to understand that God doesn't work in any different ways. He still works in the same kind of way that he was working here. And he'll still achieve his purpose to bless the race by working through the weakness and the strengths of individuals. That will never frustrate him. And where faith and godliness of life exists despite human weakness, God will be able to work around all of that. And in that we can take great comfort and hope. Well, in verse 1, we find that really this whole incident was initiated by Isaac. It came to pass, we read, that when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his eldest son, and said unto him, "My son." And he said unto him, "Behold, here am I." And he said, "Behold now, I am old, and I know not the day of my death. Now therefore take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver, and thy bow, and go into the field, and take me some venison, and make me savoury meat, such as I love. That, because I'm about to die, and I would like to have some of this before I die." Isaac was around the age of about 117 years at this stage, and he thought he was about to die. He lived for another 63 years, so he wasn't about to die. But he thought he was about to die. He felt as though he had gotten to the end of his life. Isn't that interesting, brothers and sisters? He was not about to die, and in the providence of God, he was to live another 63 years. You know, he thought he was about to die. Verses 2 and 4 tell us that. Rebekah thought he was about to die. She believed it as well. Verse 10 tells us that. And Esau believed it too, because verse 41 tells us that. They all actually believed he was about to die. And that very statement that he made there, that I'm about to die, go and get this for me, that hastened Rebekah and Jacob into wrongdoing, because they saw this situation as urgent and there was no time to wait for God. They could see that what Isaac was about to do was going to be a terrible thing. If he was going to give the blessing to Esau, it should never have gone to him. And they thought they had no time to do anything, so they hastened in to put things into place. And look at the mess that resulted. And it all started with a very simple comment that Isaac made that day about, well, before he died, this is what he'd like his son to do. You know, the problem is highlighted in verse 1. If you read carefully through this chapter, this jumps out. And it starts here in verse 1. Because it says Esau called his eldest son. You know, brothers and sisters, when twins are born, I've never, ever heard anyone call them the eldest and the youngest. Have you? You don't go around talking about twins that were born a half an hour apart as being the oldest and the youngest. Oh, the twins themselves might boast between themselves that I'm older than you. But people don't generally talk about the oldest and the youngest in the family. And they were twins. They were born on the same day, the same age. So why does this record call him the eldest son? Because it wouldn't normally ever be done. Well, there's only one reason. Only one reason. In the record, it says here that Esau called his eldest son. Because Isaac regarded Esau as his eldest son. And that phrase, the eldest son, you know where that came from. Because this problem had existed in that house for 50 years. This issue between the eldest and the youngest. And yet they're both the same age. Quite remarkable. Turn back a page to chapter 25. The only reference to this eldest youngest comes from God himself, who said that the elder would serve the younger. And that was the cause of the title eldest and youngest from then on. And look what it says therefore in verse 28. And here's the essence of the problem. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So the title of eldest and youngest came from verse 23 of chapter 25, when there were two, she was told that there were two manner of people in there, and the elder shall serve the younger. That's where that came from. It was that terminology used by the angel there that is now picked up in chapter 27, and Esau called his eldest son. You know, the very fact that he was the eldest son should, in a sense, have rung alarm bells in Isaac's mind about what he was doing. Because what had the angel said? That the elder was going to serve the younger. And now he secretly gets hold of his eldest son, who he must have known was the one who was going to serve, and the other was going to be elevated. And he tries to initiate something to give him the blessing. It's just an amazing set of circumstances here. You know, verse 5, we read, and Rebekah heard when Isaac spake to Esau, his son, underline that, and Esau went to the field. But look at verse 6, and Rebekah spake unto Jacob, her son. Here's this division that came about that we're told about in chapter 5, verse 28. His son and her son occurs again in verse 17, verse 21. It's just get a colour pencil and colour these through the chapter, because here we've got eldest, youngest, his son, her son, all the way through this chapter. It highlights where this division had actually come from. So down in verse 15, for example, and Rebekah took the raiment of her eldest son, Esau, and she put them upon Jacob, her younger son. So it's in Rebekah's mind. It's in Isaac's mind. You know, it wasn't just in their mind. It was also in Jacob and Esau's minds. Verse 19. And Jacob said unto his father, when he eventually goes in to try and deceive him, I am Esau, thy firstborn son. So even Jacob now is trying, he knows what his father thinks, and he's trying to play up to it. And again in verse 32, we find the same thing. Well, quite amazing thing. And now, so it appears that Isaac wants to get in first secretly and bless Esau, who was his favourite son. And when we look at it, brothers and sisters, there's just no way that Esau could be the heir. And Isaac knew that. Isaac knew that he'd already sold the birthright to Jacob. He knew what his life was like, that he had no spiritual inclination. He wanted nothing to do with the truth, and that from an early age. He knew that he'd already married Hittite wives, which cut right across the principles of the Abrahamic covenant, right across the family principles. And he knew that the angel had said to Rebekah that the elder shall serve the younger. Now, knowing all of that, brethren, this is why on earth did Isaac do this? Well, we know too that he was fighting against his conscience throughout the whole of this. He was actually trying to blot some of this out. He did it secretly. He didn't tell Rebekah anything about this. That in its own right tells us that there was something here that wasn't quite right. There was something secretive about this whole thing, which indicated that there was, that in his mind, he sort of half knew, in fact, he really knew that he was doing something wrong. He appears not to have prayed about it. He appears not to have involved God in this at all. And when he actually gives the blessing to who he thought was Esau, but in fact was Jacob, he says absolutely nothing about anything spiritual. And then his reaction at the end is quite clear that he knew that he was going against his conscience. You know what he'd done, brothers and sisters? He did what you and I are very capable of doing. When there's something we really want or we want to do, and we know very, very clearly if we stopped and thought about it, we could list 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 reasons as to why we shouldn't be involved. But we just turn a blind eye to that, and then we pull the blind so we don't have to think about it. And then we go ahead. It's exactly what he did. Oh, he was terribly distraught after it was all over. Because all that flooded back into his mind, and he was very conscience-stricken, as we all are, when sin blights our lives. But surely the question that is being begged here is, why did Isaac love Esau anyway? What was the attraction of this godly man to a man like Esau? Well, chapter 25 tells us, we won't turn to it now, that it was because he did eat of his, it says venison, but he did eat of his hunting, the Hebrew is. He was actually mesmerized. Verse 3 and 4 here give us the indication here in chapter 27. Excuse me. Gives us the impression that he was mesmerized. Isaac, that is, was mesmerized by all the things that Esau was doing, by the equipment, the prowess, the excitement of the kill and the hunt. And though he himself could never do that, he seems to have been for a moment temporarily blinded to the true nature of Esau because of all this that Esau was involved in. And he used to actually like it when he'd come home and tell him all the stories about how he'd hid in the bushes and behind the rocks, and he eventually got this animal or that, and then he gave it to his father and he ate it. Oh, and his father was just so happy about it. Now, Isaac had been completely deceived and his eyes blinded to the true nature of Esau, and that brought real problems into that family. So his favour was based upon all the wrong reasons. And if he'd stopped and thought, he would have come to exactly the same conclusion that Paul came to in Hebrews 12, that Esau was a profane man. The word means irreligious. He had zero interest in spiritual things. So Isaac's action here with Esau was purely selfish and fleshly, which was uncharacteristic of the man. This was not the true Isaac. He did not live his life perpetually like this, but here was a blight in his life that he was obeying his natural senses. And you know, brothers and sisters, whenever we get into that situation, it will inevitably lead to tragedy. Perhaps not as quite as tragic as this, but it very well may. Well, verse 6, 5 and 6 tell us that Rebekah heard when Isaac spake unto Esau his son. Now, she wasn't meant to hear. Clearly she wasn't meant to hear this. Isaac wasn't going to tell Rebekah and didn't want her to know. In fact, the RSV says Rebekah was listening. But here, Rebekah then, once she hears this information, is motivated by the divine promises to take things into her own hand, because she saw this situation as desperate and, in fact, very urgent. There was not much time. She only had between the time that Esau had gone out into the field, caught an animal and come back, and she knew that that wasn't going to be very long. And she saw the seriousness of this situation because she said so in verse 7. She came to Jacob and she said, "Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I command thee." Verse 7. I'm reading verse 8. This is what she told Jacob, that she heard his father say, "Bring me venison, make me savory meat, that I may eat and bless thee before Yahweh, before my death." Now, Isaac didn't actually say that. You can notice he didn't say that if you compare a little earlier. Isaac didn't say, nor would he have said to Esau, "I will bless thee before Yahweh, before my death." But what she did is she added those words because she knew that the blessing was going to be connected to the Abrahamic promise, and that this blessing could never, never go to this man. And so to impress Jacob with that, she adds the words here, "before Yahweh." And it was true. It was a serious matter. There's no question about that. And she was seeing the situation right from that point of view. She believed the promises, and she now saw that they're in danger of going to Esau, and what a drastic thing that would have been. So she galvanizes into action, verse 8, and says to Jacob, "Obey my voice and according to all that I command you. Now go to the flock and fetch me these kids and prepare this. I'll prepare this savory meat," verse 10, "and thou shalt bring it to thy father that he may eat and that he may bless thee before his death." So she's got this whole plan all worked out. You know, in the divine record, brothers and sisters, Rebekah is always painted as a woman right from the very first time we see her, a woman of decisiveness, a woman of action that just gets up and makes a decision and goes. And it's almost every time in the right direction, apart from him. So it was a good characteristic, this, in her life, but here, though it was motivated by good reasons, in fact, she went off track. And under pressure, under the urgency of that situation, the Syrian in her nature came out. And so true is it too for us, brethren and sisters, that when we're under pressure, the flesh comes to the fore. You know, she could have prayed about this and left the matter in God, but we don't read of that. And like us, that is often the last resort. It's after we've tried everything else that we involve God. And unfortunately, she'd already devised this plan and she was ready to put it into action. And we read about that in verse 8 because it says, "Obey my voice." And she listed off all the details of this plan. In fact, three times in this chapter, in verse 8, verse 13, and then a little further over in verse 43, we find Rebekah insistently saying, "Obey my voice." This was not the voice of faith. This was the voice of the Syrian. It was not the normal voice of Rebekah. It wasn't that voice that had been cultivated over many years in the house of the patriarchs with the love of the promises. You know, Jacob even knew that this voice from his mother was not right on that day. And he often and continuously listened to his mother. And for good reason, because she was a godly woman. But this day he knew that voice wasn't right. Look at verse 11. Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold," he's protesting, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. Peradventure, my father will fill me, and it shall seem to him as I shall seem to him as a deceiver, and shall bring a curse upon me, and not a blessing." You know, it was a feeble attempt, really, on his part, but he knew it was wrong. He doesn't actually say to his mother it was wrong. He says, "What if I get caught?" Which is the very natural reaction of the flesh, isn't it, brethren and sisters? We see it in our children often. And sometimes we mask it and deceive ourselves into thinking that we don't do it ourselves. But it's our first natural reaction. To just think of the consequences instead of what's right. And Jacob would have been much better to have come out and said, "Mother, that there's no integrity in that. We've got to leave it in God's hands." And she would have turned around. But he didn't. He protested, but not on the right grounds. "What if I'm seen as a deceiver," he said, "and I get caught out and I get the wrong end of the deal?" Not the way to go. That's the flesh again. But secretly, Jacob really wanted what her plan was going to provide. And so, in his mind, no doubt, as we are wont to do at times, he could justify that. He was a great wrong that his father was about to do. And what was that great wrong in compared to just a little deceit to try and help things along? Have you ever thought like that, brothers and sisters? Sometimes we don't even consciously think like that. But looking back at our lives, we sometimes get into a situation where we would compare one sin with another. Say this one, "Oh, well, really, we just had to do this at the time because this was so bad over here." And that's the problem that Jacob himself got into here. But because Jacob didn't actually take the right course and say this was wrong, verse 13 reads, "And his mother said unto him, 'Upon me be the curse, only obey my voice.' And the voice of the Syrian came through louder and stronger." There was this voice of the Syrian that overrode the voice of his conscience, which was there. The voice of his conscience was working, but not strongly enough. And he just got overridden by the voice of the Syrian here, which was compelling and persistent, just like the voice of the flesh in us, brethren and sisters. And it pushed God out of the picture. It fought with the conscience. It rationalized sin. And in the end, it had deceived all parties. And we know that that works like that. This story is not just something that happened to Jacob and Esau and Rebekah and Isaac on that day. We know that that story is repeated in our lives 1,000 times. But Rebecca's plan, and it was her plan, it wasn't Jacob's. Rebecca's plan was that we get in there and make sure that the promise goes to the rightful owner as God had already promised. And in that she was right. But here as Jacob hearkened to her voice, he got into very serious trouble. And through this incident, God was going to remove Jacob away from the voice of that Syrian influence, away from the voice of his mother's influence, which he was unable to stand up to, and help him to appreciate the voice of the Syrian and how serious it really was, because he could not see the seriousness of that when it was coming from a person he loved. When it was coming from the mouth of his mother, he couldn't just see how serious it really was. You know, there's some powerful and relevant lessons here, brothers and sisters, for us. Because this whole set of circumstances is not foreign to us. This innate voice of the flesh that calls loud and strong and rationalizes sin and blurs the boundaries in our thinking is one of the terrible burdens that we bear. And hearkening to this voice, brethren and sisters, in us, will bring terrible consequences. What's the answer to that? What should Jacob have done? What should Rebecca have done? What should we do? What do we learn from this whole circumstance? Well, there's an attempt to start with to allow the inner voice of conscience to answer the voice of the Syrian, to answer the voice of the flesh. But it was overridden because the voice of the Spirit was not stronger, not strong enough. And our only answer to the voice of the Syrian that's innate in us, brethren and sisters, the only answer is to strengthen the inner voice of conscience. And we've come here to this morning to remember our Lord, who is the only one who ever finally crushed and completely ignored the voice of the Syrian in his life. And what do we read of him? Every morning, not some, every morning he opened his ear to his father and gave him time and allowed another voice to develop, a voice that would be strong enough to stand up against the voice of the flesh. And whenever he was faced with the voice of the flesh, the voice of the Syrian in his life crying out to him, we find him on his knees in prayer. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the voice of the Syrian became exceedingly strong. So strong that he was distraught and it appeared on his face. That's how strong that voice was crying to him. And he could have given in, brothers and sisters, but he never did. Because he bowed himself in prayer and he didn't do it once because the voice of the Syrian kept coming at him. He went back again and prostrated himself on the ground. And because it was still not won, he went again and prostrated himself until the voice of the Spirit overcame the voice of the Syrian. There was no other way, brethren and sisters, that we are going to defeat it either. And Jacob failed that day, as we do sometimes. You know the reaction that Jesus had to Peter when he suggested that this would never happen to him. You won't be crucified, Lord. They won't do this to you. You're going to be the king. Jesus turned to him. Get behind me, Satan. That shocked Peter, the intensity of his reaction. But there was another voice in his mind that he'd renewed every day that was crying out and putting down the voice of the Syrian. But you know, brothers and sisters, it's very easy for us, is it not, to justify some circumstances that happen to us. And here, Rebecca and Jacob were driven by good motives. They knew that Isaac was making a wrong decision. It was something that they couldn't really turn him around from. So they thought the best thing that we can do is, because we know what God's will is in this circumstance, the best thing we can do is just twist it a bit. But you know, brothers and sisters, the end never justifies or sanctifies the means or methods by which we do things. Never. We are never just justified in breaking God's principles for the sake of expediency, however right the end might seem to be. You know, none of us would disagree with that, brothers and sisters, but listen to this little quotation. Because in practice it tends for us all to be a little different. As one writer says, sometimes just a little thing is needed to make everything go according to our liking. The keeping back of a small fact or a slight variation in the way of stating a matter. Things just want a little push in the right direction. Oh, we see that happen so transparently, don't we, brothers and sisters, in our children. And if we're observant, we'll see it in our families, we'll see it between adults, we'll see it in the ecclesia, we'll see it in our interactions outside. To override the conscience, brethren and sisters, on small things things in order to achieve something that we really want or that we really believe in or that we're passionate about is simply to deceive ourselves, as was clearly evident from this situation. God does not need the aid of elements like Rebecca's cunning and Jacob's gross deceit in order to accomplish his purpose, nor does he need ours. But at times we feel constrained to just push in the right direction, just to say things, just so that things go according to the way we perceive them. But let's never, ever forget that the overarching picture is that God sees all that entangled interaction and he will still bring about his purpose. The heeding of the voice of the Syrian brethren and sisters produces devastating effects. In the life of Jacob and Rebekah and Isaac, it did too. Do you know Rebekah lost her son as a result of that incident? Jacob left the house, fleeing for his life, and she never, never saw him again. Jacob lost all the comforts of life. He lost the consolation of a godly home. He lost everything he had, and he walked out with a staff in his hand. And he fled for his life and lived all his life in fear of his brother, with great misfortune that followed all his days. It's a tragic situation, brothers and sisters. And we find that Jacob comes now to his father, very uncertain and hesitatingly, and makes his first lie in verse 18. And then because he hadn't pulled out, God gave him an opportunity. God gave him a chance. But he goes into a second lie that involves God in the plan. And then into a third in verse 24. There had been a way of escape. But as sin is wont to do, it rolls like a steamroller and takes us with it. True enough, he had the hands of Esau that day. He had Esau's coat and Esau's skin and Esau's food and Esau's untruthfulness and Esau's smell. But the only thing that Isaac picked up on was the voice. And he said, "Is not this the voice of Jacob?" All his other senses let him down. And here was Jacob with the hands of Esau coming to his father, but his own voice. And his voice spoke what he was really thinking inside. And he used the name of God that Esau would never have done. So unwittingly, what was really at the base of that man, the things he really loved, started to come out of his mouth, as it always does in ours. Jacob was not in a comfortable position. It was not where he belonged. This was not the true man. And the blessing was laid down upon him that contained not one single element of the Abrahamic promise. There was no mention of seed, no mention of land, no mention of all nations, no mention of eternity, no mention of El Shaddai, which were all elements of the Abrahamic promise. None of it. Only about material and political prosperity right here and now. And the story ends in verse 30. It came to pass, as soon as Isaac had made an end of blessing Jacob, and Jacob was yet scarce gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from his hunting, and he also had made savoury meat and brought it to his father, and sent it to his father, "Let my father arise and eat my son's venison, that thy soul may bless me." And Isaac his father said unto him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am thy son, thy firstborn Esau." And Isaac, as the margin says, trembled with a great trembling greatly. It was a devastating experience for Isaac. An awful moment of truth where finally his conscience was caught up. This dramatic realization of his utter folly, that God had actually been working through all of this. God had seen his evil plan and turned it on its head and thwarted his intentions. It's no wonder he trembled with a great trembling greatly, brethren and sisters, because that in that very instant he realized that he'd been working against God through this whole situation. That he knew that God had known everything that's going on in his head. Everything. And that despite his scheming, God had still prevailed. You know, his transformation was instant. He never tried to blame anyone. He was humbled under the mighty hand of God at that moment. And he said at the end of verse 33, "And he shall be blessed." You know what? He could have turned around and said, "Oh no, Jacob's jolly well deceived me. Let's cancel all that and I'll now give you the blessing, Esau." He could have done that. But he didn't. He said, "The blessing's going to stand." Because he realized that God had superintended that whole thing and had, in his own weakness, worked through this to give the blessing to the rightful owner of it. You know, that incident is taken up in Hebrews 11 as a great act of faith on the part of Jacob. It's a response of a very great man where his real true self came to the light again. Here was an aberration in this chapter, and God was able to work through it. And when God pulled him up, brothers and sisters, his response was utterly amazing. He humbled himself completely. He didn't blame Rebekah. He didn't blame Jacob. He didn't blame anyone else. He took entire blame himself and was just thankful that God had taken over in that circumstance. Quite amazing thing, brothers and sisters. You know, and God is still at work. I suppose the most amazing thing about that incident is that despite the human weakness that's involved, God is still able to work out his purpose. And that for us is incredibly encouraging because we find ourselves in the same state as Rebekah and Isaac and Jacob sometimes. And to know that God is still, if truly our hearts are set on him, even though we go off in weakness at times, if our hearts truly are fixed on him, if that's the foundation of our life, if faith drives us in reality, even though we might fall in weakness at times, we might pull a blind down and forget those things that we know, God will still work out his declared will. Do you know what his declared will was in that family? The elder shall serve the younger. And for us, brethren and sisters, it's no different. The elder will serve the younger. Is God's will in our lives? You see, the younger, the elder is the first man that was born, earthy, Adam. Our natural thinking was the first born. The second born in us, the younger, is in fact the new mind of Christ that's been formed in us. And God says the elder is going to serve the younger. The younger, the mind of Christ, has got to rise up above. So whatever we do that tips that balance, like Isaac tried to hear, is going to be thwarted if we've got our eyes and our ears set on the promises that are to come. Brother Robert said, God may be guiding our steps, not only in the midst of, but by the very means of circumstances that in themselves appear to be evil. They might even be wrong. And we might have even been the ones to perpetrate the wrong. And God can still use it to bring about his purpose. What an amazing thing that is, and how encouraging it is for us all as we consider the grace of God in our lives and the greater than Jacob who's set before us that we've come here to remember. I'd like you in conclusion to just look at the words of a simple psalm in Psalm 24 that brings together the contrast between the Jacob of old, as godly a man as he was, and the greater than Jacob that we've come to remember this morning. Because here David asks the question in verse 3 of Psalm 24, Who shall ascend into the hill of Yahweh? Who shall stand in his holy place? That's exactly what Jacob wanted to do, and it's exactly what you and I aspire to, is it not? Well, here's his answer. He that hath clean hands, not Esau's hands, a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul in vanity or sworn deceitfully, as Jacob did that day, he shall receive the blessing from Yahweh and righteousness from the God of his salvation. And here we have a man before us, brethren and sisters, who was pure in heart and clean of hands, in whom there was no vanity and no deceit and no malice at any time. And that's the generation we want to be part of. We've come to associate ourselves with him and to put away the hands of Esau and the early hands of Jacob and to grasp hold of our great example before us. Verse 6. This is the generation of them that seek thee, seek him, that seek thy face, O God of Jacob.